are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 16th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, New York Magazine writer Eric Levitz. And the Dems can abandon the center because it doesn't exist. I imagine we will also probably touch on the events of the day. Also on the program, whoops! Donald Trump's racism spills out in public. And Baltimore drops a Confederate monument in the dead of the night. Alt-right demonstrations scheduled for 9 cities. And just a friendly reminder, we're careening towards a debt ceiling crisis in September. Meanwhile, Trump's approval at a new low, and after yesterday, will there be a cabinet jailbreak? Meanwhile, GOP primary headed to a runoff in September. I should say in Alabama in September. And the winner may end up being the guy who believes Sharia law is the law of the land in the land of Lincoln, Illinois.
Yes. Is it a thought experiment?
No.
Oh, because if it was, he would be very sophisticated.
Meanwhile, in light of the fact that racism no longer exists and we don't need a Voting Rights Act, federal court invalidates Texas's congressional map because it's racist. And fentanyl, an opioid linked to thousands of deaths and counting in urban centers around the country. All this and more on today's Majority Report. yesterday was, I don't think it should be a surprise to anyone who has really been remotely paying attention. Donald Trump, and it's certainly, according to all the reporting, not a surprise to his staff, just a surprise that he would let his freak flag fly as president of the United States, I guess. From the New York Times piece, as of, last night or this morning, depending on if you are digital or paper-based, Trump gives white supremacists an unequivocal boost. It's always what you want to read about your president. President Trump buoyed the white nationalist movement on Tuesday, as no president has done in generations. It's always important to be a superlative. Equating activists protesting racism with the neo-Nazis and white supremacists who rampaged in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. Skipping ahead, no word in the Trump lexicon is as treadworn as, quote, unprecedented. But members of the president's staff, stunned and disheartened, said they never expected to hear such a voluble articulation of opinions that the president had long expressed in private. Let me reiterate. They are shocked, stunned, disheartened. I'm adding to this, probably dismayed. Gary Cohn, it says, after that, to Treasury Secretary and Steve Mnuchin, who are Jewish, stood by uncomfortably as the president exacerbated a controversy that has once again engulfed the White House in disarray. Other reporting says that Gary Cohn is completely enraged. And are they enraged because they're working for a president who holds views that are at best very sympathetic with Nazis and white supremacists? No, that's not the problem. They're enraged because he said it out loud in a press conference. How embarrassing. I wonder if Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin are just thinking, hopefully we got enough distance between now and the high holidays so that when I go to synagogue in October to celebrate Rosh Hashanah, everyone in the synagogue doesn't look at me as if like, oh, I'm the guy who is helping prop up Nazis in the country. I mean, right now, first of all, if the ADL wants to even continue to pretend that it cares about any of this shit, they should be calling on Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin to resign immediately. Gary Cohn should be feeling the vast amount of pressure right now. Because this is going to turn out all the whining from the Republicans who voted for this guy, all the establishment Republicans who continue to prop him up, even the Bushies who are sending out their notice from Kenny Bunkport where they won't say the name Donald Trump. This is all just going to blow over in 2 weeks, just like the pussy grabbing tape. The weak link here is a guy like Gary Cohn, who does not want to be known in his community as being supportive of a guy who is propping up Nazism in this country. And he should be feeling the full brunt of the pressure, because once he goes, they're no longer getting cover from that guy, right? As long as Mnuchin and Cohn are there, everybody's looking around. Look, I mean, if the Jewish guys are here and they're okay with the Nazis.
Do you think it's a mistake that Mnuchin was next to him when he went on that tirade?
I mean, they're both finance guys. I mean, who knows? I think it was just a coincidence. They were there for an infrastructure deal. But the bottom line is they're giving cover to all the other cabinet people. It's not about Donald Trump anymore. I mean, no one's going to influence Donald Trump to be less of a Nazi sympathizer, to be less of a Nazi. Whatever it is, he is. But Gary Cohn can be pressured because he's got to go out into the real world. He can't stay in the little bubble. At one point, he's going to go to his country club. He's going to go to his synagogue. He's going to go home, and he's got relatives. And they're all going to look at him, and they'll be like, really, dude? He's a Nazi. And Gary Cohn should feel that pressure. And once he goes, then Mnuchin has to say, like, oh, do I really want to be the only Jew here supporting the Nazi? And then once he goes, it becomes cascading. That's what's got to happen. And I don't know if it's some group. I don't know if the ADL will have the balls to do it. They won't. They're a right-wing organization more often than not. But there should be some, I don't know if it's J Street is the right group, but there should be some conference of rabbis. I imagine there's various rabbinical groups that are out there. Maybe ones that are, you know, dedicated towards equality in the country, and they should be out in front of Gary Cohn's synagogue is what they should be doing Friday night at sundown and talking about, where's Gary Cohn right now? What's he say to this community? That's what should be happening. It's out in public. There's a reason why Gary Cohn is upset about it. And it's not because he's working for a Nazi. He knew that. Or a Nazi sympathizer, or whatever you want to call it. He's mad it's in public because now the people he's going to sit next to in synagogue, the people at his country club, the people when he goes out to dinner are all going to look at him and realize the stink is on him now. And that has to be emphasized. And now is the time. So I didn't want to get that. I didn't want to get that hyped up about it, but.
Well, I'm really hyped up. Okay.
I'm sorry.
I don't like that he's not condemning Nazis, but when you buy, to teenage sex slaves together in Estonia, you bond. Okay, right. You know, the president's a pretty amazing guy. Okay,
I mean this is an opportunity. I hope it's not wasted. I hope it's not wasted. I got an email. We should just maybe give a heads up to the guests that we're going to be 5 minutes late. I got an email. I don't have time to get into it, but it was a listener, Ty, who yesterday I was using, I was saying that Islamic terrorism is not analogous to white supremacy because of what is being modified there and what you're actually talking about. Islamic terrorism implies that the terrorism comes out of Islam. And I was talking about this in relationship to white supremacy, white nationalism. And listener Ty writes me, I don't have too much time to go into it, but it's basically that white and whiteness is a construct that was fabricated more societally and then codified in law in Virginia's 1924 Racial Integrity Act. Remember, that was also the same era as we started celebrating Jim Crow and post-Reconstruction. And he explains that white people, the construct white people, would be analogous to the construct Aryan people, suggesting a certain racial purity. And he said this is illustrated by the fact that if you're a white woman can have a black child, but a black woman could not have a white child. Suggesting that whiteness is definitionally a pure race. And so white supremacy, the supremacy part, is a construct in the same way one would say Aryan supremacy. It's almost redundant. I don't have time to go into it, but it's something I wanted to just mention. The flaw that Ty found in my example yesterday, and I think it's probably worthy of a much more longer discussion. And so I will find a guest, and we will have that conversation. But I just wanted to get that house cleaning done with. And it was a fairly compelling email. Not fairly, very compelling email. Meanwhile, as an aside, I've spoken to you before. If you've had a kid recently, I hope you get life insurance. For me, it was term life insurance. And then I had a kid 10 years later. If I had known, who knows? But nevertheless, life insurance can be confusing, time-consuming, and if there's ever a payout, you won't be around to enjoy it. But one company's making it a lot easier. PolicyGenius.com is the place to learn about life insurance, compare quotes from America's top providers and save up to 40% on your policy. I've told you, when we took these guys on as a sponsor, I went on the site and I went through the whole thing as if I was to buy term life policies from today. I went to other sites to double check that the firms that I would have purchased from on Policy Genius were legit and highly rated, because you want an insurance company that's going to be there, you know, by the time you croak. I would have saved a significant amount, even though I bought my policy 10 years ago when it was cheaper. Well, obviously, when you're younger, it's less expensive. So the best time to buy is actually right after you have a kid, at the very least. Or if you have any other family members that are going to need support if you go. If you have any questions, they have a team of licensed experts waiting to talk you through it. No call waiting, no pressing a ton of buttons. You get actual customer service. And they don't just do life insurance. You can get health insurance, insure your pet, even protect your income, whatever you need. If you've been putting off getting life insurance, you want to make sure the insurance you have is right for you, check out PolicyGenius.com today. You can save up 40% just by comparing policies. Quotes are free. There's no sales pressure, zero hassle. PolicyGenius.com. It's life insurance for the 21st century. Also, today is Wednesday. And people around the office know that Wednesday is the day that I eat well. Why? Because we get our Blue Apron on Wednesdays and Thursdays.
Yummy. Hello.
It's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. For less than $10 a meal, they deliver seasonal recipes along with pre-proportioned ingredients right to your door. It's great. If we ever have any leftovers, it's tiny and it's gone by the end of the evening. Which is, you know, maybe a problem if I'm eating it. But Blue Apron, it's completely flexible. You can customize your recipes each week. You choose a delivery option that fits your needs. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promise you that every ingredient arrives ready to cook or they'll make it right. Some of the meals available in August include basil pesto chicken with summer vegetable panzanella. I have no idea what panzanella is, but that's what's also been great about this. I'm learning stuff about food. Sauteed shrimp. Green beans with globe, tomato, spinach, and orzo pasta. We had that the other day, actually. That was delicious. Whole grain pasta and summer vegetables with heirloom tomato caprese salad. Miso butter salmon with lo mein noodles and cucumber and charmed tomatoes. Meatball pizza with fresh mozzarella and charmed tomatoes. That's the problem with this. Every time I read this, I literally start salivating. Sounds so good. Check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook. And lastly, have you inherited an old coin collection or an accumulation of coins and currency you're not sure what to do with? Littleton Coin is here to help. Somewhere in my house, I think in my dad's house, I have like books of pennies that I saved when I was a kid. I'm sure they're nothing. They're probably not worth anything unless you find one of those like steel ones from 1942 or something. But you never know. For over 70 years, Littleton Coin has been helping people just like you sell their coins and currency. As an industry leader in collectible coins and currency, Littleton can pay you more. Plus, in 2016, the company's president, David Sundeman, received the ANA, American Numismatic Association Dealer of the Year Award. I don't know, the coin collector is a little bit nerdy. That's why I probably have I have my own coin collection.
This is like you and food. Like coins.
Littleton Coin was honored with the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for Marketplace Ethics. So these are people you can trust and rely on. Whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is the place to sell your U.S. coins and currency. This process is incredibly simple. Visit Littleton Coin.com/majority to learn more. That's Littleton Coin.com/majority to learn more. or you can give them a toll-free call at 1-877-857-7850. Tell them the Majority Report sent you. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Eric Levitz from New York Magazine.
Yeah, okay.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, the associate editor of the Daily Intelligencer at New Yorker Magazine. Eric Levitz joining us on his piece, Dems Can Abandon the Center Because It Doesn't Exist. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Long-time listener.
I'm glad to hear that. And I have to say, it was another listener who called into the program yesterday, and a guy from Mike from Pennsylvania, long-time listeners of this program will know, who is who says that he prints out, and he's he I don't know if he works for the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, but he is a an organizer, and he says that he prints out this article that you wrote, I guess, a couple of weeks ago now, and he's handing out to everyone he knows. He made it rather compelling for us to bring you on, and. The timing of this is, I mean, obviously, we're looking to 2018 now. I don't think there's any, anything probably more compelling, at least from electoral front, than 2018. And give us the set of fundamental laws that you see promulgated by nonpartisan pundit or Sunday shows, or really just sort of, and this has been a long time, I guess, a set of immutable laws. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So basically, the kind of background assumptions that frame a lot of the Sunday show talk and sort of inform even the headlines in straight news media is that the electorate's divided almost evenly between liberals and conservatives, with these moderate swing voters marooned between them. I think the second law is that the ideological range of the American public opinion is relatively closely mirrored by the division of federal power by our nation's elected officials and their positions. And thus, the more each party can move its platform in the direction of the others without alienating its core base of support, the better its chance of capturing the center and within a majority and thus political power.
Go ahead.
Just that these ideas sort of all derive out of this thing called the median voter theorem, which came into prominence in the middle of the 20th century and was originally formulated by economists, and it has sort of that characteristic narrowing of human nature that we find in so many sort of economistic theories of how people behave. Where it kind of imagines this electorate that's composed entirely of ideologically diverse but uniformly rational citizens who are seeking to, maximize the percentage of their political policy convictions that they've arrived at just through their individual sort of contemplation of the world, and thus, you know, that there are these people in the middle of the spectrum that parties can, you know, compete to win.
And so let's zero in on that term rational, too, because there's a presumption underlining that rational would mean that your cues to vote would be a function of how someone else deems ideological, you know, sort of ideological purity, right? I mean, the idea would be like, if I hold this ideological stance or this position, then a rational person would also hold that stance. That's part of the reason why this breaks down, isn't it?
Yes. The first way that this breaks down is that it's a one-dimensional, it's a unidimensional spectrum from left to right that this theory sort of puts out, which is how you can get kind of a median in the middle. But that presupposes that you've got voters pretty much consistently, if they have liberal positions on some issues, then they also, if they have liberal positions on, like, let's say, economic issues. So if you believe that Social Security benefits should be expanded, then of course you must also support gay marriage. But of course, you know, in reality, there's no particular inherent reason why anyone would hold those two positions. And in fact, America is full of people who believe that, you know, we should protect or expand Medicare, and also that gay people shouldn't be allowed to teach in school.
And I would also add, I mean, I think there are people who believe, like, oh, we should expand Social Security, but we should also, be very careful about the deficit. You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing to sort of say that this divide is also just between economics and, more social issues, or equality issues. But it can also be just sort of like not necessarily having a full sense of an inconsistency in the context of even those silos like economics.
Right. I mean, this is the other thing, is that public opinion on most issues is very incoherent and mutable. So, and it's very heavily dependent on framing. One thing that I cite in my piece is that throughout the Reagan years, throughout the 1980s, 60% of Americans in most polls agreed that the federal government was spending too little on assistance to the poor. But only 20% said that the government spent too little on welfare. And so, obviously, these phrasings call to mind different pictures in the minds of the people that are being asked. And how you frame an issue really can fundamentally change whether or not that issue has majority support. And that's true of polling, but it's also true in our politics. One thing that I didn't include in the piece, but that I thought was really striking, was after the Grenfell fire in London, Jeremy Corbyn proposed the state essentially confiscating these properties, these unoccupied luxury apartments that are owned by, like, foreign oligarchs for a temporary time, and putting the people who the Grenfell Tower was this public housing unit, public housing tower in London. It caught fire. It killed a lot of low-income working people, and it displaced a lot of others. And so his proposal was, let's just take these luxury apartments that are just lying empty. Let's put the poor people in them. Now, if you were to put that position on a left-right spectrum, that's really hard left, because it essentially evinces contempt for property rights. The idea that the state can just grab these things because they're not being used in the way that the state wants them to. But in polling, it got around 60% support, and that's because I don't think people don't fundamentally plot things on an ideological spectrum and then say what they're willing to accept. They go on the basis of the stories that policies tell, and specifically who wins and who loses in the story that's being told. So if you ask the average Londoner, you don't need to be that left-wing to say, do I care more about preserving the property right of the oligarch who is driving up rental prices in my city, or do I care more about these people who are homeless and would I like to see them in that apartment? I think it's really, really heavily about identity and about who is being served by various positions. And that, I think, leaves politicians a lot of room to move the ideological spectrum if they can tell a good story.
And I mean, and part of it is almost as if that people, even, I think, I think even people who from the outside are perceived to be ideological, really, that is a sort of a determination almost that like a, I don't know, it's like a reviewer pulling a theme out of a book. You know, it's not necessarily what the writer intended. It could very well be that, like you say, that, you know, just I guess to rephrase it in a different way, that people can have a set of policy responses that are not based on some political or ideological set of principles, but rather, how they just simply react to and think is the proper outcome.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's outcome-based, and it's also, you know, that one of the arguments in this book that my piece relies on a lot, Democracy for Realists, is that fundamentally people, part of the reason why the economist view of human beings breaks down in, you know, economic theory often, but especially when it tries to get into political theory, is that we are not atomized individuals, you know, no matter how much technology is pushing us in that direction, fundamentally human beings are social and they're tribal. And so what really determines voting behavior is group identity. You know, politicians can try and craft and try and make some identities more salient than others. So, for example, Hillary Clinton, really, her campaign really worked hard to try and make suburban, slightly right-leaning women put their gender identity ahead of their historic partisan identity and say, look, you know, look who Trump is. He is an enemy of your people, of people like you. Whereas Trump targeted old Union Democrats with reservations about immigration and somewhat racially reactionary views that were somewhat latent or whatever, and told them to put, you know, their racial identity, their conception of American identity, ahead of their historic partisan affiliation.
I want to just circle back to one more aspect of the idea of trying to get that centrist voter. That you make the point, the consensus position on any single issue in the United States is rarely located at the center of a left-right ideological spectrum. Just expand on that for us.
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the those three laws that I set up at the top, I think the most pernicious one is number two, the idea that the ideological range of American public opinion is well reflected in the ideological positions of people in Congress. Fundamentally, that point presupposes that we have a very well-functioning democracy and we have responsive government in the United States. And that's, you know, not the case. There's the famous 2014 study from Berkeley, UC Berkeley, that found that, you know, the provocative headline was that America is oligarchy, not a democracy. But fundamentally what they found was that organized interest groups that are business-oriented and that are very well-funded and are big-money groups have an independent influence over what happens in public policy, and mass interest groups of ordinary working people tend not to. And so the outcomes that happen in Congress, you know, don't reflect the range of opinion. And in fact, especially when voters haven't been coached by their the leaders of their party on what they should think is reasonable and is not, and in what is, you know, an extreme policy and not, you end up with really, really interesting answers. So the one study I cite in the piece by David Brookman, what they did is they went, they took like 13 issues and they polled people, they gave them seven options, not just the options that are present in our current debate, but options that are way far to the left and way far to the right of what is permissible on these issues. And what they found is that they're really, is a decent amount of support for pretty extreme views. So what I cite in the piece is that when you gave out those seven options on marijuana, by far the consensus position was the legalization. On immigration, the most commonly held position at that time was mass deportation. And on taxes, was really interesting that the first two options were tied at like 25%. One was the Democratic Party's platform at that time, basically a slight raise on people above like 250,000 Another one was a slightly more aggressive version of that. But the third most popular option was a $1 million maximum income, confiscate everything above that. It was only 13% of respondents said that. But that was more than four times the amount of the percentage of respondents who said that their preferred position was the Republican Party's platform on taxation. That got like 4%. Wow. So, you know, if we had parties that accurately reflected views, a confiscatory taxes above $1 million would be a more mainstream position than cutting taxes on the rich, you know.
And the point being that ultimately, if you were actually to find, I mean, we hear a set of policy options attributed to the moderate voter or the centrist voter who turns out to actually would never hold. I mean, statistically speaking, the centrist or moderate voter that we hear people talk about on the national news would never hold those positions. They would all hold positions significantly to the left of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, on some, you know, socio and cultural issues, it's possible that you could
shade to the right.
But on the economic stuff, I mean, the thing is that the Republican Party's economic philosophy is so marginal. I mean, and they know it. You know, they don't campaign on it. That the way that they ran against the Affordable Care Act in 2016, and before that, in the way they've sold their plan, betrays the fact that they know that there is no big constituency for conservative economics. You know, that they ran promising. They critiqued the Affordable Care Act. Mitch McConnell, you know, critiqued the Affordable Care Act because it left, you know, what, like 30 million people uninsured, and that people have insurance that they can't afford to use because the deductibles are so high.
Right.
These are obviously not their objections to Obamacare, which are more along the lines that they, you know, slightly dipped into the passive income of millionaires, and that also would ever further entrench the idea that government actually owes its citizens anything, specifically its working class and poor citizens. But yeah, their ideology is extremely marginal on economic issues, and it feels like the mainstream media does not scold the Republican Party for that marginality nearly as much as it does when the Democrats take any baby steps towards the left.
So, all right. So if we if there's basically three, I guess, prongs to the debunking of this myth, that one, you can't really measure what the center is on this type of spatial one-dimensional spectrum. Two, that even when you have come up that the notion of what the moderate position is usually, and if not always, a fundamentally wrong. And three, that you know, that there's this that the ability of the voter to really understand what the party represents in terms of proposals is also wrong in terms of policies. I mean, you make the point at one point that 27% of white voters who wanted to see more liberal policies than Barack Obama had followed voted for Trump. And
yep.
You similarly made the point too, that at one point that in 2012, and this is going forward as to what you're suggesting the Democrats should follow, is that Barack Obama's 2012 campaign rhetorically was more populist than Hillary Clinton's in 2016. But her platform, and not just the Democratic platform, I think, like, you know, literally what you could find on her website was significantly more populist and progressive in its policy prescriptions.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, just the you know, bottom line is that the number of Americans who are choosing how to vote by going to the websites of the candidates and reading the policy prescriptions and looking for independent analysis and checking what, you know, Ezra Klein says on Vox about whether these are viable policies, it's not a large number of people. You know, for the most part, it's these broader campaign narratives, you know, that I think to the extent of messaging. And a whole other point is that which I don't really get into the pieces, but just the whole obsession with the center gets us focusing really pretty exclusively on messaging rather than on organizing, rather than on, you know, how do we have build institutions that can mobilize voters. I think that's a huge part of the story of the Republican Party's ability to have a marginal, economic philosophy and still win elections, is that they found ways to mobilize and institutions to build. But
So in other words, they're not as focused on this idea of how can we convince or change people's minds. It's how can we organize those people who already identify with us and make sure that we maximize what we have.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the astounding things about the how central the center concept is in discussions about the Democratic Party is just how radically, not just Trump, but the whole modern Republican Party's trajectory refutes the idea that, at least inherently, moving away from consensus public opinion is bad for political parties. So the evangelical right's views on public policy, you can get, if you word things correctly, majority support for some of their views on abortion. But for the most part, the evangelical right is and always has been in the extremity of their social views, a minority in the United States. And when the Republican Party, which initially, was a prime supporter of Planned Parenthood, started moving away from them in the Reagan years, they were moving away from the center and from the genuine sort of consensus views of the American electorate. And that was a great thing for them because the evangelical right, this was a group of voters that, their turnout rate was lower than average before this era. And now, in an era where we don't have unions, these evangelical megachurches, they can really turn out the vote. In last fall, the evangelicals turned out at a much higher rate than the average voter, and they delivered their votes 81-16 to Trump. And I mean, this would not have been a close election without the evangelical right.
So you write, if the center's dead, then is everything permitted? Is it? And I mean, and this is basically where you say, there's obviously you have to be thoughtful about what policies you project, because even when you are, I guess, not pretending that those positions are centrist, there is a force out there that's going to inhibit your ability to, theoretically could inhibit your ability to mobilize on that, and that's just big money.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that there is, part of the reason why this concept survives is because there isn't, it's not like there's no basis for it. Like, I believe there is research showing that, moderate, quote-unquote, candidates tend to do better. There tends to be a very strong correlation between moderate candidates and money, so, right, they're better funded. I say in my piece that, one implication of the deconstruction of this idea is that party elites have a lot of freedom to set the agenda, to move the ideological goalposts of the country, because the American electorate is not so rigid in its policy views as we paint them to be. And I do think that that's true. The problem is that we are in a political system that allows unlimited money to flow into elections, and we've got more billionaires than ever before, and they're more politically active than ever before. And the fact that the electorate is very impressionable in their views means that, if the Democrats run on single payer, probably they get less insurance and pharmaceutical money, I would think. And that money can be used to paint Medicare for All as the first step to Soylent Green, can freak people out, and people are loss averse. And they, it's not like there isn't an obstacle here. So, in the piece, I note that you've got big money, and then you've got often it's a partner in crime, white racial resentment, which can be leveraged by the big money to really make things hard for the left in the United States. And so, there are real obstacles to moving left. I think that the metaphor of the center constrains our ability to really name specifically what is it that we're up against and how can we navigate around it, because it, in its presupposition that we have this really fixed playing field and that there's a very clear and definite realm of what's possible.
And so once we have we've stripped the argument down to what's really at play here, ultimately, you argue that that moving towards a populist direction on behalf of the Democrats, ultimately, even though you're clear-eyed in the obstacles there, makes sense. Why?
Yeah. So I think, look, the thing is that are there risks in moving left? Yeah. Are there risks in sticking with the same messaging and policy that has brought the Democratic Party to this point? I would think so. And certainly there's risk in moving right. I mean, look, you could try to appeal to these cultural conservatives in the Midwest or whatever, but you also need to spur turnout among the Democratic base and get them politicized, and especially among African Americans and Latinos. Moving to the right on those issues is a serious risk. So I think the argument for the moving left, on economic messaging is just pretty robust. Like I said before, the Republican Party has a minority vision on economics. And so the Democrats have everything to gain from polarizing the electorate around views on pocketbook issues. Lee Drutman, a political scientist, did an analysis of data from the Voter Study Group and found that a full 26% of the American electorate expressed what is in our country considered right-of-center economic views. 74% were on the left on that. On identity, so-called identity issues, Republicans have like a one-point advantage over Democrats, but we have a huge advantage on economics. And so we need to, Clinton really deliberately tried to not polarize the electorate along class or economic lines. Her message was reject Donald Trump's bigotry. In 2012, Obama's message was not reject Mitt Romney's bigotry. It was Mitt Romney is the guy who fired all your dad. And I think that is a more effective way to go. So as far as just messaging, in terms of policy, I think the argument for the left is simply that we have huge problems in this country in terms of inequality and in terms of climate change, and not just inequality as this like moral concern, but as in inequality is really crippling our economy's ability to create jobs, to create wages and productivity and economic growth. And the left is, I think, the only ones in this country that have even plausible solutions to these problems. We're going to have to transition our energy infrastructure to clean energy, ASAP, or else the human project of civilization is done. There's no way that we can do that if we're not going to challenge the American public's current consensus on government intervention in the economy. We need to move the public left. We need to take that risk at some point, or else we're, going to be screwed. I think that's the main impetus. And then the argument for why just electorally it actually could be to our advantage to do this, to do what's right, I think it is just, again, sharpening the economic message. So, Trump was able to divide the electorate along racial attitudes and attitudes towards immigration. Rhetoric did a lot of the work of that, but he also had a signature policy that made it, gave it half in credibility, which was the wall. And so if you look at, what could be the signature policy for Democrats that really highlights, their vision for the country, the more centrist positions are not, they don't tell stories as well. The Affordable Care Act is a really complicated device that doesn't tell a great story. But if you do, we want a tax on a Wall Street financial transaction tax that's going to pay for universal health care for everybody or whatever. It tells a very clear story, that Wall Street is making too much money. The American people are not getting what they deserve from their government. We're going to do something about this. And so I think that effective storytelling and effective mobilization of identities requires having an us and a them.
Right.
Identities gain strength through their opposition. So Trump did a really good job of bringing out white people's sense of racial identity by creating these non-white monsters, these, Islamists and these marauding, murderous, undocumented immigrants. The centrist Democrats are very hesitant to really create, or have been previously, they're actually, I think, moving a little bit, to create an enemy, and what Bernie Sanders was really good at doing was a millionaire and billionaire class, everybody else is against them. And I think that embracing rhetoric and policies that highlight the divergent interests of the broad American public and the richest people in our society can potentially not just lay the groundwork for policies that are really necessary, but also win some election.
It does seem like the Democrats are beginning to at least reflect that understanding. I mean, I don't know how sincere some of them are, but, you know, the danger for those who are not sincere to express that those sentiments are that, you know, you start to a ball rolling and it becomes a little bit tough to control. So that, which is why exactly, like, I don't really care. They come out and espouse it. It creates a certain amount of pressure. I mean, there's a reason why the Republicans now are desperately trying to get a repeal and replace bill passed, because, you know, they promised it. And they feel that they're going to suffer because they're not delivering. Theoretically, it's the same dynamic, right? I mean, what do you think accounts for that? Is it Bernie Sanders' success? Is it that it's bubbling up from below? What do you think accounts for that change?
Yeah, I think it's Bernie Sanders' success. And I think it's also the forces that produce Bernie Sanders' success. You know, I don't think that the Obama administration, I think it took a while for people to realize what the implications of the 2008 crisis, and specifically, maybe even more importantly, the weakness of the recovery since then. We're living through the first post-recession recovery since World War II, where the economy has not caught up to the output trajectory that it was on before. And you've got right now, last week, Bloomberg reported we're back to the pre-crisis level of private debt in the country, because, you know, American families, to keep up their living standards, the wages do not make it possible in order to get the stuff that is the basic infrastructure of middle-class life, like an education, transportation, a home. So I think the long class generally has started, see, these realities are so stark that no one can really ignore them. The Republican Party has stopped ignoring them. In 2016, you did not hear nearly as many pions to job creators, and you built that. You heard a lot more rhetoric of populism, even from people other than Trump, you know, the idea that the middle class was left behind economically. And you see, I think, in the progressive think tank space, that there's just been a natural gravitation towards skepticism of corporate power, the antitrust issues bubbling up. So I think that there is a lot of promise for progressives in this moment. You know, one issue that's going to be difficult is that the Democratic Party has a very good relationship with Silicon Valley, and it's hard to understand how you can do robust antitrust policy while maintaining that. You know, so that's one area of concern. The other is that the right of the party is not dead, and it is mobile. It is active, but the blue dogs, what remains of the blue dogs in Congress, are they're finding primary candidates for 2018, and they have money. And I don't know. I think a lot of great stuff is happening at the national level and at the most visible level. I do think that we may wake up to find that if we survive till 2020, you know, that there are a lot more conservative Democrats in Congress than we had bargained for,
right.
Which is partially a reflection of the way the districts are drawn. But yeah.
Well, Eric Levitz, the piece is Democrats Can Abandon the Center Because the Center Doesn't Exist. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll link to your piece at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot.
Tremendous.
Thank you.
He's apparently a fan of...
I had heard. Well, he called him reactionary Mandela.
Right.
So maybe he's listening to another show.
That's right. Very possible. Maybe there's a... All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Story breaking on the Times. I don't know how real this is, but should be interesting. A hacker known only by his online alias Profexer is apparently been identified by American intelligence agency as... the guy who wrote a program that was used in the hacking of the Democratic National Committee. But apparently the Profexer, the online persona, has vanished. But a man who claims to have been Profexer turned himself into Ukrainian police earlier this year, maybe because he was afraid of what would happen.
Yeah,
to
he
him.
Should be.
And
trust me.
He has now become a witness for the FBI.
Look, everyone condemns racism, but when you think about it, isn't Charlottesville a giant distraction from how rotten my wife's campaign was?
This story is going to, if it's true, I mean, look, I haven't been terribly invested in how emails were taken or whatever the DNC material was taken. I know there was a report out recently in the Nation magazine that suggested that 2 megabytes was too fast of a download speed or something to that effect. And I've seen I've seen people who are computer experts say that's not the case. But nevertheless, if there's an actual human being who is a witness who's still alive, it's going to be rather problematic for people who have tried to build their entire careers off of the notion that, you know, this was all about Seth Rich.
I'm going to start calling you DS Cedar for Deep State Cedar. It's disgusting the way you run interference from my wife's criminal activities in the DNC. And while everybody's all worried about Charlottesville and that false flag, there was an email that came out from 2014 where Debbie Wasserman Schultz said that we need to get organizers on the ground to build a firewall for my wife in the primary. Think about it. If that's not the most disgusting thing you ever heard, meanwhile, oh, yeah, Donald Trump, yeah, he created racism, sure. I'm not saying Donald Trump's not bad, but I'm saying that problems go much deeper. And if Barack Obama and my wife and Debbie Wasserman Schultz didn't exist, you wouldn't have Donald Trump. So go ahead. You're working. He ought to write you a check for his reelection campaign, shilling for the DNC.
Who should write me a check?
Donald Trump.
All right. Fair enough.
But just get in line. Vote for Kamala Harris. It's great. Go for it.
Oh, God.
You're a shill.
Folks, please, please.
Mini MSNBC. Please.
We're just begging you. Do not put any more Jimmy Dore videos in our Twitter timeline.
It's making us lose our mind.
Well, we'll talk about it in the
final. Fucking sellout.
All right, we got to take a break. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. Day in, day out. The free show, of course, is not free to produce and involves time and effort. We think it's important. I know a lot of people have asked, I specifically was asked recently, like, well, the fun half is more like shows that have gotten really successful.
Yes. Exactly.
So why would you put the fun half behind the paywall and the, you know, the, I don't want to say the drier, but the stuff that's a little bit more narrowly tailored in terms of stuff in the first half? Like, why wouldn't you put the interviews in the fun and the you know, in the premium part? And it's basically because we have guests on that I find are interesting topics or important topics within politics that I think need to be amplified, and this makes the most sense to me from that perspective. Not necessarily the best business thing, but so and so for those people who do enjoy that and think it's important, supporting the show is really down to you. We do have ads, and we have been getting more ads than we had, let's say, two years ago. But it's not nearly, like I've said, 93.8% of our revenue. Sometimes it's like it goes from like 96% of our revenue comes from our members. So join themajorityreport.com And as a bonus, then we give you the show that would be really successful and popular that that we're not going to let people hear.
Always said this, and then the truly the most popular show, which would also be offensive, would just be literally what we say in The Office that is not on air for anybody.
Well, that's probably true.
That's the one that would really blow up.
So we're just we're doing a little upside down, and it's your support that makes it possible. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Fair trade coffee, delicious free shipping. And if you buy your crap from Amazon or jet.com, do so at our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Also, give us reviews on iTunes. You can give, when you're there, go to the Majority Report, give a review, and then go to Too Much Michael Brooks, TMBS. And
on iTunes, it is The Michael Brooks Show, so everybody's clear.
On the iTunes, it's The Michael Brooks Show. Head over there, subscribe to that, and give it a review. All right, quick break. We'll be right back after this. 646-257-3920. Right back after this.
Situation.